Muy buenos días a todos. Bueno, es realmente un placer muy grande iniciar este primer seminario de la primera edición del Máster en Razonamiento Probatorio y iniciarlo con un colega de inmejorable prestigio en el tema, en el ámbito, como es el profesor Ron Allen. Hemos querido hacerlo en un espacio particular. El espacio es esta sala de grados, antigua capilla del monasterio que era originalmente la hoy Facultad de Letras de nuestra universidad, y que creo que es uno de los espacios más significativos de la universidad desde el punto de vista arquitectónico. La Universidad de Girona empezó su andadura, los estudios universitarios en Girona empezaron su andadura aquí al lado, en el edificio que hoy es el rectorado de la universidad, en 1460. Y poco después empezaron también estudios universitarios en esta sede. Formalmente la universidad, bueno, se clausuró poco después, 100 años después, pero en términos históricos, ¿verdad? Se clausuró porque se clausuraron todas las universidades de Cataluña, por disposición de Felipe V, y ha tenido una vida como el Guadiana, de aparece y desaparece, hasta hace 25 años que se crea formalmente la Universidad de Girona, ya con este nombre, así que este año hemos celebrado 25 años. En un sentido, pues, la Universidad de Girona es muy joven y en otro sentido es muy vieja. Y aquí es donde podemos ver mejor que es muy vieja o muy antigua. Y teníamos tuvimos la ilusión de poder inaugurar con el seminario inaugural del máster con un profesor del nivel de Ron Allen y con un espacio de la belleza de esta aula magna y de este claustro que tenemos aquí afuera. Ron Allen es John Henry Wigmore Professor en la Facultad de Derecho de la Northwestern University en Chicago. Ha sido conferenciante probablemente en todos los continentes, ¿no? En un sinnúmero de países. Es miembro de distinguidísimas asociaciones como la American Law Institute, la Association of American Law School. Ha sido vicepresidente de la Rule of Precedent of Evidence Committee of the American Bar Association y es actualmente presidente del Board of Advisors of the New Evidence and Forensic Science Institute, con sede en Pekín. Desde 2007, el Ministerio de Educación de la República Popular China le otorgó el título honorífico de Yangtze River Scholar, que es solo la cuarta vez que se otorga a un extranjero y la primera y única hasta el momento que se otorgó a un jurista. En los últimos años ha coordinado diversos grupos de investigación para la formulación de propuestas para la reforma de la legislación probatoria en diversos países, en China mismo, para la nueva legislación en materia de prueba de la República Popular China y también en Tanzania. Su obra respecto a temas probatorios es realmente vastísima y con algunos trabajos que son absolutamente imprescindibles para quien quiera trabajar en temas de carga de prueba, para quien quiera trabajar en temas de presunciones, para quien quiera trabajar en un buen número de los problemas probatorios hoy en día. No quiero tomar más tiempo. Simplemente, Ron, it's a real pleasure for us to have you here, and especially for the opening seminar of this first edition of the program, of the master program on evidential reasoning. It's Girona is always open for you, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for what I am sure was a very kind introduction, and I have to say it that way because, like a typical stupid American, I speak English and a little bit of French, and that's all. But it is both a great pleasure and a great honor to be given this inaugural lecture to the new master's program in evidential reasoning. Spain is the world's leader in many things, and among them is gracious hospitality. And my wife, Julie, who's with me here today, and I would like to thank you for making our visit absolutely perfect. I should warn you, however, that she's a real lawyer, so you better watch what you say. It's a great honor for a number of reasons. Girona has quickly established itself as one of the important centers of research in the field of evidence. As much as it's a great honor for me to be here, I think it's a greater opportunity for those of you who are fortunate enough to be admitted to study in this program. You will have available to you the best of the present thinking about knowledge of, quote, evidential reasoning, unquote, in the Western world. And you have the opportunity to be exposed to a wide range of cognitive tools, tools of thought and inquiry that can be brought to the task of increasing understanding of the nature of juridical proofs, specifically in the field of evidence more generally. You have throughout the university a distinguished faculty, but you're most fortunate to have Jordi Farrar-Beltran and Carmen Vasquez Roja as your intellectual guides in the journey you're about to undertake. Dr. Ferrer is at the forefront of research into evidential reasoning on the continent of Europe, well demonstrated by his masterful article, Legal Proof and Fact Finder's Belief. And Dr. Vasquez has become completely fluent in the much different methodology and approach to the field of evidence that are now prevalent in the United States. And I suspect this is one of the reasons I was invited to give this lecture, Carmen. Between the two of them, you'll have an opportunity to learn both the conventional views of the two most important intellectual traditions in the field of evidence, but also, and much more importantly, to grasp the direction that research is going in both. And in fact, I envy you. I wish that rather than sitting here in front of you today, I could join you on what will prove to be a fascinating and intellectually gripping journey of discovery. Now, you have all got the paper that I prepared, and you've had a chance to read it. So it's pointless for me to read it to you. But I did prepare PowerPoints that hit the highlights. So I will just quickly go through maybe 25 minutes, 30 minutes, these PowerPoints to set the scene, and then we can discuss, which I would much rather do in any event, as much as you like. In preparing this paper and thinking about a master's in evidential reasoning, what I was thinking about is, first of all, an overview of the field of inquiry, then at the end, coupled with my thinking about the direction, the most fruitful direction that things are going, and as you now know, I think that's into what's called the field of complexity or complexity theory. So let me just go through the PowerPoints quickly to set the stage, and then we can discuss. For those of you beginning to think about these kinds of issues, you have to be very clear that there are three and only three kinds of work that can, intellectual work that is done. Normative, and by that I mean the inquiry into norms, obligation, what's right and what's wrong. Analytical, the bringing of tools of inquiry, decision theoretic tools, logical thought to bear upon whatever the problem is, and empirical. Interestingly, what you get in the continent is an emphasis on the first two, primarily normative with analytical tools being brought to bear. And what you get in the United States is much more going in the different direction of a combination of the empirical and the analytical. So you have these different traditions. Within the scope of empiricism, which is what I do, I'm an empiricist, trying to find out what actually is happening in the legal system, there are really interesting questions about the nature of the legal system that involve evidential reasoning. How does it actually work? Now note the parentheses, not what do people say or think about it. How does it actually work? Be sure to distinguish the rhetorical, or indeed even the analytical, from the empirical. What in fact are the legal's objectives, not what should they be, and how well are they achieved? Not what, again, what do people say they are, but what actually are they? Is there a difference between what they are and what they should be? Very important question. How does the mind work? And now we get closer to the kinds of empirical questions at the heart of your journey, in my opinion. How is knowledge reliably constructed and utilized? And what are the implications for a legal system of the answers to those epistemological questions, the study of knowledge? How does proof work? It's a central part of the task that you'll be studying in this program. This will soon become very important. It is not the only task. Evidential reasoning may sound like it's nothing but an epistemological inquiry, but that's false. The epistemological inquiry exists in a context, and what other variables or issues inform the field of evidence, and what you'll soon see is that is in fact complicated. And then finally, at the end of the day, what are the laws and rules of evidence in any particular jurisdiction that emerge from all this, and what do they actually do? Now, when you think about these things, keep these next set of ideas in mind. You're studying evidential reasoning that intersects the law of evidence, but the law of evidence doesn't exist in the abstract. It's part of a theory of litigation. You're trying to accomplish something with your litigation system, but the theories of litigation are themselves part of a theory of government. They emanate from your prior conception of what government is to do, and theories of government vary dramatically. Even across the continent, and especially the comparison between your approaches and ours, you see dramatic differences. Maybe most importantly, dispute resolution involves fact-finding, and there are disagreements about the most efficient and effective way to get to the truth. And the last point on this slide is critically important, and we'll come back to it in just a second. There are other values than truth. And the law of evidence and the field of evidence reflect this fact in very direct ways. Now, I've mentioned the epistemological problem, fact-finding, and that's probably what you thought you were going to study. But there are at least four other variables that create a complex optimization problem for any legal system, and these are the other four. The law of evidence also has an organizational component. It allocates power and discretion. It orders the relationship between actors and branches of government. And I'll elaborate on this in just a little bit. There's a governance problem. The field of evidence, the law of evidence, actually deals with the interaction of litigation and primary behavior, not just litigation behavior. The point of litigation is to create the conditions of a flourishing society. At least it's part of its point. And thus you have to ask questions about what a flourishing society is, and how does litigation behavior, by which I mean things that occur with respect to litigation, and primary behavior, by which I mean everything else that you do, right, out there in the real world, how do they interrelate? How do they intersect? And what I'm going to suggest to you is that one of the interesting things is that's part of the complex optimization problem. You have to optimize the relationship between these. But trials serve other purposes than just litigating facts. They are performative events. You can obstruct governmental activity. And so this is the social problem that the law of evidence has to intersect with, or again, is part of the optimization problem that it faces. And then last, you have the enforcement problem. When you get finally to thinking about how to write rules of evidence or laws of evidence, you have to think about how those, what I write down in a paper, a statute, a rule, is going to be enforced out there in the real world. And in particular, those enforcing the law may have different incentives from those writing the law, and creates obvious problems for the person trying to construct a rational law of evidence. Now, the significance of facts. It's critically important to realize the significance of the epistemological problem. It's also important to realize the reality of a legal system. It deals with the most important issues of lives, people's lives, and fortunes. You would not want a legal system to gyrate radically over every new idea that comes along. You have expectations that have been built up. And even though you might now think some new fact-finding procedure is, you know, the best thing since sliced bread, you have to think carefully about whether to introduce it. This is the problem of conservatism, that people build up expectations that you do not want to defeat. Part of this, of the epistemological problem, is natural reasoning processes. When does a legal system defer to natural reasoning, and when does it not? And what you will discover is there are times when it defers when it should, in other words, it embraces natural reasoning, but there are times when it does and you probably will think it should not. And the opposite is true. There are times when the law of evidence does not defer to natural reasoning, when it shouldn't, but there are times when it doesn't and it probably should. These are critical variables in the question of evidential reasoning. When you think about these things from this perspective, this is a very important point that I expect to return to. We'll see how the time goes. We talk about science. I'm going to talk about evidence science because I actually think it is developing. But there's an interesting difference between the legal system and any scientific inquiry. And that is that in scientific inquiries, without worrying about what we mean by science, just accept it as a general conventional term, the scientists of that kind pursue issues that can be pursued. They don't spend time pursuing issues that cannot be pursued. The structure of their knowledge creates problems that need to be solved and points to those that actually can be solved, and those are the ones that you focus on. If they don't have enough information, they don't decide. This is different from the legal system. It's a critically important point to keep in mind. The legal system has to decide. If it does not decide, it decides. Not deciding is a maintaining of the status quo. The status quo benefits somebody. By not deciding, you decide. This is one of the tragic dilemmas of the legal system. And I'm going to talk about a good example of the problems of the legal system versus science and witness credibility when, again, seeing how time goes at the end. The organizational problem, you probably haven't thought about this, but think about it. The law of evidence actually organizes the relationship between everybody participating in the process. So it's not just a matter of inference and evidence. It's a matter of who should be doing what, when, how. The law of evidence exercises power over who is deciding. It distributes discretion to different branches of government. If you have a robust law of evidence, whoever wrote that law controls the process. If you do not have a robust law of evidence, whoever is controlling the process controls the process. In particular, the distinction between legislatures and judges, but not just them, because the law of evidence also allocates discretion to parties. So you see that dynamic operating as well. In terms of the organizational problem the law of evidence involves, or the field of evidence, there's also another general problem about the utility of rules. Complex rules actually have social implications. They benefit those with the wealth and knowledge to implement them. In the law of evidence, the field of evidence, that's an interesting problem. How can a person sue a bank? The more complicated the law is, the more difficult it is for a person to sue a bank. The bank has the expertise, the person does not. Now, think also of the other, of the governance problem. Again, and this is a critically important point, the legal system doesn't exist as a thing in itself, for its own purposes. It exists to further larger goals, aspirations of society generally, reflected in the governing structures of your society. So there is an interaction between litigation behavior. Litigation behavior is supposed to do something. It's supposed to create, among other things, incentives so that you don't have to litigate. So there's a governance issue. that gets you to really interesting questions about the economic and social values of incentives. To what extent is conditioning, constraining truth determination at trial worth it because of its effect on some other value? Exclusionary rules that are designed to encourage the police not to violate privacy is a good example. And here again, you always have to think about primary versus litigation behavior. Think about the problem of errors, which is a big problem in evidential reasoning. The conventional analysis of legal errors looks at how many mistakes you make at trial. How do you allocate errors in civil cases? How do you allocate errors in criminal cases? Is it different? And so on. But note what this conventional view neglects. It neglects that it's not just errors at trial that matter, but errors of settlement. Settlement occurs in the shadow of trial. So if I can't get a fair trial, I'm going to have to settle in a way that I give up some of my rights. So the legal analyst, you, have to think not just about what's going on at trial, but what's going on in the shadow of trial. That's settlement. And you have to think about cases not settled. What are the incentive structures being created that even generate litigatable disputes? But when you're optimizing this and you're optimizing litigation behavior, it's not, again, just litigation behavior that you're trying to optimize. Correct decisions matter too. There are four kinds of decisions that can be made at a trial. Two kinds of correct decisions for plaintiff, defendant, state, criminal defendant, and two kinds of wrong decisions. The focus on errors in the conventional legal analysis in the field of evidence is important but incomplete, because you also have to focus on correct decisions and the effect of all that on primary behavior. What incentives does this structure give us out there in the real world so that hopefully we don't litigate? Because litigation is what we call a deadweight loss. It's throwing money down a rat hole. Instead of paying lawyers, you could be paying lawyers' salaries or law professors' salaries, right? Or student loans or some other more important variable than this. So what about the social problem? I don't know if this is such a big deal in Spain. In the United States it is, that they're performative events. People make points through trials. What do your trials reflect about your commitment to ideas of fairness and equity? How are you making, not just the parties, but the government, the society at large, making statements through the kinds of institution that you have? And the enforcement problem. This is maybe obvious, so we can do this quickly. Rules on the books are one thing, rules in action are another. Let me give you just the quintessential, the perfect example from the United States. You all know the Miranda rule. The Miranda rule is designed to make the police, to guard defendants' suspects' rights to be free from compelled self-incrimination, and so you read them. The Miranda court said you have to tell the person of his rights, and you have to get a waiver of those rights before you can question him. Well, who implements that? The police. The police have no incentive to implement it in a way to make it effective. Their incentive is to make it ineffective, because they want the person to talk. As a consequence of this, the Miranda rights in the United States have become almost meaningless. There is no discernible difference in the rate of people confessing, talking to the police in the United States before Miranda and after Miranda. Why? Because the police neutralize it. So this is just a startling example of the difference between the law in the books and the law in act. Well, there's the example that I just spoke about. Now, back up about all of this. I want to make a point about the significance of fact-finding. And this is critically important for you all, that we have this complex optimization problem, but at the same time, the epistemological side of things is critically important and maybe the most important of these five. And the reason for that is that without accurate fact-finding, and I mean this seriously, without what you're studying, without what you're doing, rights, and obligations are meaningless. Every conceivable concept of a right or an obligation that you can come up with, I mean, that isn't, you know, absolutely crazy, and maybe even those, is utterly dependent upon accurate fact-finding. Take property as a paradigmatic example. Jordy thinks he owns this computer. You thought you owned this computer, by which he means he gets to possess, consume, dispose, and control this object. And I say, it's mine. I'm taking this home with me, sorry, but there you are. How are we going to resolve that? This so-called right is going to be resolved by Jordy finding a fact finder, call him a judge, call him a jury, call him what you want, you're going to present evidence that you either found, made, were given, or bought this item. Those are the ways you can come into property. And on a certain day at a certain time, and the fact finder will determine how the world was at a certain day at a certain time. And that property right will be dependent completely and utterly on that fact finding. So it's accurate and efficient fact finding that is, in fact, one of the most important pillars of the flourishing of Western society, and frankly. All right. Now, how do we go about all this fact finding? And what I'm starting to do now is to increase the complexity of the structure that we're dealing with. What I've tried to show, just a quick overview, is that what you thought maybe was a straightforward epistemological problem isn't. It's much more complex than that. And now I want to show that even the epistemological side of things is more complex than you think. Where is this going? It's going towards complexity, towards the theory of complexity, and so on. I'll just use a simple example. You use probability all the time. I do, everybody does. But what does it mean? It's a critical foundational component, as I say here, and here's the point about the significance of facts, but it's poorly understood. So I want to explain some of the problems here, again, to open up avenues of inquiry. I want you to understand its complexity and reflect on its meaning. Now, think of the conventional uses of the term probable and its derivatives. It will probably rain tomorrow. The People's Party, I'm told, will probably remain the largest party in Spain. I can't find my phone. I probably left it at home. The DNA at the scene matched the defendant's. At 13 STR loci, therefore it's probably the defendant's blood. Have you ever thought systematically what you mean by any sentences like that look like this? It's a really interesting question. It turns out that there is a thing called probability theory, and the foundation of it is Kolmogorov's axioms, and this is what the mathematicians talk about. This is the source of your belief that if you flip two coins in a row, two fairly weighted coins randomly tossed, you'll get the probability of getting two heads is 0.5 times 0.5, 0.25. This is the foundation of modern statistics. These are the axioms. I'm not going to go into the axioms. You'll be, I'm sure, happy to hear. But we could if you like. But what do these numbers mean? Mathematics, including probability theory, in my opinion, there's a deep philosophical argument about what's called mathematical realism and so on. But in my opinion, the irrealists are right. It's simple, empty formalisms. They're interesting formalisms, don't misunderstand, but they're empty formalisms. For the real world, the question is, what does the interpretation of the mathematics mean? And what does the interpretation of probability mean? Well, there are four interpretations of probability, and none of them work very well for the law. It's actually quite interesting, not in a systematic way. The first is actually called classical logical mathematical probability. This is abstract thought experiments about, again, equally weighted coins, equally weighted die. What's the abstract probability of getting a number on a die thrown an infinite number of times? That bears no relationship at all to the law, zero. The second interpretation is called propensity. Popper developed this. It's a terribly powerful explanatory interpretation for things like radioactive decay. Quantum theory, to some extent, actually embraces it. That has nothing to do with the law. Relative frequency is what you normally mean by probability. Go back to those examples, some of them in any event. The DNA example is clearly an example of relative frequency. And what you mean by relative frequency is the size of subsets within a larger set. So if you have a set of coins flipped randomly, fairly, over long run of cases, the two subsets of heads and tails will tend to converge. That's what you mean by relative frequency. That's what's implicit in most of your uses of the term probably. It will probably rain tomorrow. Given what I know now, I would predict tomorrow, based on my experience, that the set of sunny days is more likely than the set of rainy days. But the problem is, you never have relative frequency data at trial. If you do, great. Sometimes in employment discrimination cases you do. Sometimes in toxic tort cases you do. But generally you don't. You have witness credibility problems. You have a person saying, I signed the contract, and some person saying, you didn't sign the contract, you didn't perform. You don't have relative frequency data. So you can't, if you don't have relative frequency data, the relative frequency interpretation doesn't work. And then the last is subjective probability. And this is what, I don't know if you all are going to deal with Bayesianism, and no. Subjective probability has to do with your beliefs. And again, it, like all these other interpretations, is quite powerful. And it consists of what are called computations on degrees of belief. But if you all are not going to study this, if you're not going to go into it, I'm going to be quite brief here. The problem is this doesn't work either. For subjective probability to be computable, you need these conditions. Let me back up. The attraction of a mathematical system is its computability. You can do things like determine the probability of two heads in a row or two tails in a row. We've already shown you never have relative frequency data, so that doesn't work. There was a very interesting development in the middle of the 20th century of trying to rationalize and organize degrees of belief, what you believe. And this resulted in what's called subjective probability. And was the last gasp of the probabilist in the law. Since none of the other versions of probability worked, they thought, well, maybe this will. Well, it doesn't. The conditions of subjective probability being computable are the ones that I list here, and these never exist in the law. You have to state all your beliefs within a probability space. You have to assign initial assignments of probability, and then you can update those probabilities in light of new evidence. But all that does is it maintains consistency among your beliefs. It does not have any relationship to truth. This maintains consistent set of propositions. So what's actually going on at trial? Well, what's actually going on at trial is not probability assessments per se. It's plausible explanations. You're searching for explanations as to what occur. And whether you do it explicitly or implicitly, all systems actually construct the process in such a way that you have competing explanations. We say in the United States that the criminal defendant never has to do anything. The government bears the laboring oar. They can just sit passively. That's ridiculous. Why is it ridiculous? Because if the government tells a plausible story of guilt, when I say story, I mean explanation with evidence, everybody in the courtroom knows that there's one person who knows whether there's another explanation. That's the defendant, whether he's guilty or innocent. He knows. If he doesn't speak, it's like Holmes' story of the dog that doesn't bark. If he doesn't speak, there's only one story on the table, and it's been supported with evidence, and that is proof beyond reasonable doubt. So even if you say, as we do, the defendant has to do nothing, that's just false. The way in which your mind works forces people to tell you what the alternatives are. And then the best the legal system can do is then create a process to choose over those alternatives. But what is a plausible explanation then? Well, a plausible explanation is all the cognitive tools, all the intellectual tools, all the thought processes that you have created over your however many years of existence. The law doesn't say you can engage in deductive but not abductive reasoning, or you can engage in abductive but not inductive reasoning, or you can, you know, use relative frequencies but you can't use subjective probabilities. It says, tell us your explanation. We will then judge its rationality, whoever the we is, judge, juror, it doesn't matter, and we will reach decision under this comparative approach. These are the things, there's a lot of knowledge about how people think. I mean, it's not perfect, but there's a lot. These are the things that are used to judge the plausibility of an explanation: coherence, consistency, completeness, uniqueness, economy, and probability. Absolutely. Indeed, at the end of the day, ex post, after the fact, what is it that you want a trial to do? You want it to reach the most probable explanation, because that's going to reduce errors over time. But the path to reaching what hopefully is the most probable explanation is not reached through probabilistic reasoning. It's reached through plausible reasoning, reasoning about real life and about the explanations that are given and the evidence provided to justify those explanations. Now, this is my point. The objective is clearly to reduce errors. Criminal cases to allocate errors in a different way, but that's accomplished through plausible reasoning. Now, what this means, again, is another layer of complexity. You can't reduce inferential reasoning to a probabilistic account. It just doesn't work. The tools are not, don't exist because they can't exist. But now think about another factor. The mind is hardwired to reduce things to simple rules. If you're living on the savanna in Africa and your kid wanders down to the river and gets eaten by an alligator, and you don't generalize alligators that rivers are dangerous, your DNA dies out. Boom. But hardwired, it's a great example. I mean, it's a terrible example. Why am I talking about alligators eating children? I'm sorry, but this is how Americans think, I guess. I don't know. But what if the river is the only source of protein? Well, now you have a complex problem on your hands. Now, this problem between simplicity and complexity, I'm going to return to in just a little bit. Often legal scholars, try to reduce things to simple rules, to simple theories, to simple explanations. I think that's not the best way to think about things. I think the problem that you face is the taming of complexity. And let me continue this story of complexity, you know, how you deal with complexity, by asking you to think about the legal system itself. You think, when you talk about the law in conventional terms, when you're not thinking hard about it, you tend to think of a set of rules governing behavior. But you know what? That doesn't exist anywhere. Maybe it exists somewhere. It doesn't exist in the continent of Europe, and it doesn't exist in the United States. What does exist? Massively overlapping forms of regulation interacting in unpredictable ways. That's a much more accurate assessment of the legal system. You have Girona, you have a city council, right, passes laws. You have the province, Catalonia, that passes laws. They intersect with the city laws. We have a thing called counties. I don't know if you have something in between provinces and counties, provinces and cities. You have a national government passing laws that intersect and overlap these, and now we have international law. But more important, so you see the point. The legal system is not a set of knowable rules, it's a set of complex interacting separate codes that interact in complex and unpredictable ways. More importantly, the social system and legal systems aren't static. Why do I make this point? Because simple rules work well in a static environment, in a simple static environment. rules of chess are relatively simple, actually, and they work just fine, even if the decisions you can make under them are complicated. But here's a very important point. Neither the legal system nor the social system are static. They change. They're dynamic. And one has to think about the ways in which they might change, predict the unpredictable, or at least prepare for it. And when you think about it from this way, what begins to emerge is the legal system, and now I'm moving towards the future of the law of evidence, is a complex adaptive system with massively interconnected nodes that can react to new inputs in the system that runs on inference to the best explanation offered by the parties. A complex adaptive system, you all know about chaos theory. A chaos theory is actually a mathematical construct. A chaotic system is one that is completely determinant, has a nonlinear change. The change in the inputs causes not linear change like a line, but nonlinear change, and is highly sensitive to its initial conditions. People talk in loose terms about chaotic systems. That's what chaos theory is, and that's the mathematics of it. That's not terribly helpful. But complexity theory is. Complexity theory deals with chaotic environments, but also deals with unpredictable events called catastrophes. So, for example, you think the legal systems and the governmental systems in the United States are stable, but did you ever predict Brexit? That's a catastrophe, right? Now, catastrophe doesn't mean catastrophe. It means an unpredictable big event, like a meteor hitting the Earth at its most fecund period, when Earth was just alive with life, unbelievable during the times of the dinosaurs. Or some people think, you know, Trump being elected, catastrophe, unpredictable event. And then the third thing that chaos theory or that complexity theory deals with is emergence, the way in which properties emerge from complex chaotic environments, like your bodies, like evolution, like a legal system. Point I'm going to make is I think the direction, the real direction, the field of evidence is going in this way. It's embracing the lessons of complexity theory and thinking about things from this perspective. Let me give you just some examples. One of the advantages of thinking about things in this perspective is you think about the effect of massively parallel processing systems and how they can exploit data. There are a number of parallel processing is where you have people talking to each other, like neurons, like a neural system. That's how the brain works. And the advantage of that is the efficient processing and use of communication of information. My prediction is that where you find things that exploit information this way, you'll find human flourishing. Well, like what? Well, like democracy, like markets, like a responsive legal system, like the law of evidence. So, in any event, when you start thinking about things from the point of view of complexity versus simple rules, what you begin to see is that the conventional conception of a rule works well in some domains, but not so well in others. And I say consider just demeanor evidence. Wouldn't it be great if you could have a science of demeanor evidence, like a simple rule about demeanor evidence? But you can't. Because whether a person's sweating because they're lying, uncomfortable, nervous about the outcome, come from a different country, aren't used to the temperature, who knows? And it's always going to be idiosyncratic. If a person doesn't look you in the eye, is that because they're lying and trying to evade, or because they have a background from certain cultures where you don't look people, authorities, in the eye? Who knows? You would never be able to reduce this to a series of rules. So let me kind of wrap this up here with a series of examples. Don't engage in physics envy. physics, you think of physics as complicated. It's not. It's very simple. It's particles running into each other. That's all it is. Now, in that context, rules work. They work really well. But so, think of this thought experiment. Suppose there were a piece of water, a molecule of water, let's say right there, okay? Every physicist in the world will tell you that where that molecule of water is going to end up is completely determined by physical forces. There's just no doubt about that. And that's why I have this guy standing here saying, where is that sucker? Where is that piece of water, that molecule of water going to go? Completely determined by physical forces. Yet no physicist in the world and do whatever you want to do. So the point is not to be dismissive of formal approaches. Many disciplines can afford physics envy because you can pick the problem to analyze. You can defer decision until new or better data is available. Or you can sometimes run replicable experiments. But the legal system has none of these. This is the point I made a little while ago. You don't pick your problems. You don't say, well, sorry, we're not going to let you litigate that case because that's like a water molecule. Who knows where it's going to go? You have to deal with it. So the point is to be clear what the problem actually is from the point of view of legal analysts. Now, what do I think what I've been saying? I think the tools of the future are going to be complex adaptive systems in chaos. This is what I've already talked about. What are examples of complex systems? And we're actually starting to get this the complexity science, complexity theory is in its early stages of development. So it's not as easy to say, here's something like, you know, we found the Higgs boson, you know, the famous experiment from 2 years ago at CERN, quite an accomplishment. But we're beginning to see that there are commonalities in complex problems. How to build roads is a complex problem. And it's a complex adaptive system. If there's a roadblock somewhere or the traffic is terrible, what happens? People adjust. They move around. The systems engineer can start to take those things into account. If you have a big city, you might think, what's the best way to get from one side to the other? Well, it's to go straight through. But if all the roads go straight through the center, what happens? You have a big traffic jam in the center. So you have to figure out ways to release that pressure. Infectious diseases are a complex adaptive system. Markets, elections, common law, I think litigation, government, legal systems are as well. So this is a, let me go back. Why do I think these things are critical? Because elections, markets, and I think the common law, and I'd like to hear your thoughts about your different approaches to law, are all bottom-up processes that exploit information in a very effective way. They allow the accumulation of information by thousands, in fact, millions of people talking to each other. There are then mechanisms by which decisions go up the system, then go back down, and you have a ping-ponging back and forth between the bottom and the top, increasing the ability to process and exploit information and to reach results. Markets have capital markets, free markets have the same attribute. The Hayekian price theory is an early precursor of this kind of thinking. And elections do as well. And my prediction, and where my work is going, is that where you find these things, you find increased human flourishing. Because of the ability, of the capacity of these large systems to process information to allow people to make intelligent choices. I think that bears upon litigation and trials as well. Now, just these are just examples to end up with. This is a neural, this is actually a functional MRI of a neural network. That's the internet. It looks pretty similar, actually. What the internet allows is the instantaneous communication among huge numbers of individuals, which allows fast communication and facilitates its processing. So where am I going with this? Well, think about the difference between a tree farm. Tree farm is a made system. Everything's nice and predictable. That's what physics is like. And a rainforest. That's what your problem is like. Looks to me like the legal system is more like a rainforest than a tree farm, permitting fluid accommodation between almost too numerous a set of variables to articulate, let alone compute. Bottom up process, huge number of interconnected nodes, and that's what I intend to explore through networks, complex adaptive systems, and so on. So, this is stuff I've already talked about. Where does this end? I'll tell you where it ends. It's not, I don't think, the Council of Despair. I think this is as exciting a time to be engaged in the things that you're thinking about as has ever been. And that's precisely because you viewing this first from the initial point of view of conventional legal analysis now have the opportunity to see how this conjoins with what is probably the most important scientific development of the last century, quantum theory, general theory of relativity, and chaos theory. And you will have as your guides, as I said previously, two wonderful scoutmasters, as we say in the United States. And rather than being up here, as I said before, I wish I could join you in the journey, and I envy the next year of your life. So thank you very much for listening.